And we have done all of nothing as this week starts. As stock markets limp along into what is going to be a big, big week for macroeconomic event risk. Welcome, I'm Ilya Spivak, head of global macro here at Tasty Live, and this is Macro Money. We're going to take you through what that macro risk is and what is likely to be the path forward here, or at least what are the scenarios for that path forward as we weigh up what is going to drive these markets. But as ever, there is a focal point, and that is almost overwhelmingly, in my mind anyway, the monetary policy announcement from the Federal Reserve. So what we're going to do here is we're going to set some staging here. We're going to look at why that's probably what is in focus. We're going to take a look at where markets have been and what they are setting up to do, and then see how a scenario analysis for those of us that are trading these markets might look into the Fed, after the Fed, and what sort of dynamics this could amount to for stocks, for currencies, and the broader markets in general. So let's begin here with just a quick recap of what happened last week. And the sort of abiding story here is one of generally listless dynamics in most markets, but for a few. And so obviously we can see here the S&P 500 enjoyed a rise of 2.6%, having declined 3.2% in the prior week. NASDAQ rebounded 3.9%, having shed 5.5% in the prior week. So we're looking at a situation here where the markets had a sizable opportunity to rebound after heavy, heavy selling and took that opportunity. And the data flow last week was fairly supportive, or at least not immediately detrimental for that opportunity. And the earnings flow that we saw offered enough that this could be done. So needless to say, markets don't move in straight lines. So when you have this kind of a large sell-off that we saw in the week before last, it isn't altogether surprising that given the opportunity, markets did a bit of digestion. The important thing here, of course, is that the sell-offs were not fully erased. So if we look at, say, the 3 weeks of selling in the S&P 500 that culminated in the week before last's explosive decline, we started to come off quite from the beginning of the month. So the very first week of April gave us that first down move off 77 basis points or 0.77% that week. Following week off 1.6%. Then, of course, that big decline of 3.1%. And then last week's bounce. So if we consider what last week's bounce amounts to in the context of the preceding 3 weeks of losses, what we're looking at is about a 50% retracement. So we've erased half of the decline. The NASDAQ was declining for 4 weeks, culminating in last week's very aggressive move, clearly. And again, what we then saw was about a 50% retracement. So we've erased half. The trend still appears to be pointed lower, but about half of the 3 week decline in the S&P or the 4 week decline in NASDAQ was erased last week. And that was the upshot of what happened. The GDP numbers that we saw were a bit mixed. They were softer significantly at the headline number than expected, 1.6% versus 2.4% or 2.5%, depending on which average you wanted to look at, Reuters or Bloomberg or something else. And when you looked at the internals, they looked much less weak, as we've discussed here before, than that number would suggest, because the really big issue was that net exports shaved off almost a percentage point from the headline GDP number, about 0.86%. And of course, net exports, I'm going to underline this because there was some comments I received over the weekend that seemed to be missing this detail. Net exports is exports minus imports. So it's a netting number. And so if you have a situation where that number is deeply negative, it is just arithmetic at that point, that the way you get to a very negative difference between exports and imports is a very large imports number. And if you look at the numbers actually unpacking all of this from the BEA, you indeed see that in the first quarter, consumption held up reasonably well, though it cooled relative to the preceding several quarters, but very modestly. And the miss at the headline really was all about imports surging and skewing that number. But of course, imports surging means strong consumer demand. So, and a strong dollar to some extent. So we have a situation here where the GDP numbers kind of offered everybody a little bit of something. The headline number was a little bit softer. The inflation component there that was built in was much hotter than expected. And so there was a bit of jostling back and forth. And ultimately, it seemed like the market settled on making no heads or tails of that set of data one way or another in directional terms. Then Friday, the PCE numbers came out and they were a little bit warmer than expected. And ultimately, we went nowhere on Friday. The markets came off a little bit on that number and then came back to close basically unchanged. So it seemed like the gravitational pull of this week's Fed meeting was already in play and conviction absent. When you look at really what delivered these strong gains for markets last week, it was mostly coming from the earnings front and mostly coming from Google's parent, Alphabet, which had a tremendous report for markets, and they certainly rewarded sentiment on its basis. When you look at what happened with yields, very modest further increase in the 10-year and the 2-year rates, but really bond markets idling in a range across most of maturities at this point. So not really anything of substance going on there. Crude oil bounced a little bit, retracing the prior week's decline somewhat. No major moves there. No major headway made one way or another. Ditto the U.S. dollar, looking at the euro, 6E, its main counterpart. It didn't really go anywhere. The dollar weakened about a half of a percent after a slight weakening in the prior week. Again, not really going anywhere. The yen had another decline of 2%. That's been something of a standout all by itself in the currency world. But as we see now at the beginning of this week, there was some official intervention from the Ministry of Finance. It looks like they haven't actually copped to it, but it certainly looks like in thin holiday liquidity, Japan was off for Showa Day on Monday. And because of that, liquidity was very thin. The yen attempted to make a run at 160 to the US dollar, which would have taken it to 35-year high, or further into 35-year highs, we should say. And it seemed like officials stepped in. It was a violent push in the other direction. But the yen has seemingly decoupled from other U.S. dollar-based dynamics. And of course, the other interesting thing was gold took a step lower as geopolitical risk around the escalating tensions between the Israel and Iran sort of axis of what's going on around the two major conflicts that we're following here. One, of course, in Eastern Europe with Russia and Ukraine, and the other in the Middle East and sort of all of the various parties around it. The Israel, Iran sort of node is at the center, but of course the U.S. is involved. The Gulf states are involved. There is a level of involvement from a whole sort of range of actors here. But there was meaningful concern about serious direct escalation between Israel and Iran, and that seemed to get the loop closed, and it seemed like both sides stepped back from the brink. And so gold took a one-day leg lower and has since been listless. So really the story last week appeared to be of digestion, of retracement, not of trend development. Which brings us to what we can expect this week. And of course, the very first thing to keep in mind, front and center, is the FOMC monetary policy announcement. No changes on the menu this time. Markets are overwhelmingly convinced that the Fed is not going to actually move rates up or down. And there's no update to official forecasts. The dot plot, the summary of economic projections document that includes the Fed's best guess at what it's going to do with policy this year, does not get updated until June. What we're going to get here is a policy statement and a press conference with Fed Chair Powell that's going to give some color around that statement. Now, when the Fed last updated this in March, they reiterated what was their December call for three cuts this year. We can see that big green line right across the middle of the chart on your screen. That's 75 basis points in cuts. That's three standard 25 basis point sized reductions. That was the Fed's call in December of last year. They reiterated that call in March. And we can see that as U.S. economic data, and in particular inflation data, came out hotter than expected, the markets have shifted to something much more hawkish. Stocks were able to rally as long as the markets were on the dovish side of the Fed. So even though rate cuts have been diminishing in their expected scope since the beginning of the year, from as many as 158 basis points at the start of the year, which of course looked somewhat incredulous even then, moving into parity with where the Fed was at three cuts by the end of the first quarter and essentially erasing any kind of a tailwind from expectations of cheaper future money that the Fed ultimately would have to begrudgingly accept, taking that off the table. Now it's the other way around. Now the market looks at the Fed and says, you're not nearly hawkish enough. We've just had three inflation numbers that were hotter than expected. We've had a bunch of other economic data that was hotter than expected. So you're going to have to do less. So if we look at where the market now sits, it's 29 basis points. That's 125 basis point cut and about a 16% chance of a second one this year. Whereas the Fed officially is still at three. Now, last week, we didn't have any commentary from Fed officials. They're always mum the week before a policy announcement. So that was not surprising. But the week before, we started to get a little bit more hawkish commentary from key officials, including, of course, Fed Chair Powell, New York Fed President John Williams. So it was starting to look like the Fed maybe is inching in the market's direction here. The scenario breakdown seems to go like this. If the Fed says the path of least resistance is still that we're going to cut this year, but perhaps to a lesser degree, that much is probably already priced into the market, and stocks are probably going to like something like that because they will have said, oh, the Fed didn't do anything worse. This was better than it could have been. And that's probably something of a supportive narrative for stocks. It's probably a little bit of a damaging narrative for the U.S. dollar, which has been rallying since the beginning of the year. Modestly so, but nevertheless, biased higher since the start of 2024, as we've seen these rate cut odds diminish. If the Fed, on the other hand, says, look, we've seen 3 months now of inflation data that was hotter than expected, This is, at this point, 3 points that make a line. And so we can't be as cavalier about saying we think the path of least resistance is some amount of cuts. We have to go back and reset. So if the language out of the Fed seems to be, listen, there's full data dependence here. If we don't feel like there is room to cut, we're not going to. Just because we've said that we looked like we were aiming at it, now the data has evolved otherwise, and we've always said that we're data dependent first and foremost. So now we're in a place where we're not so sure. Now, of course, they're not going to say this explicitly, but if that's the message that the markets walk away with, well, then the automatic building in of 25 basis points into this forecast no longer makes sense. So far, the Fed has said, we think we're probably cutting. So at least one cut seems overwhelmingly necessary in the outlook if the market is going to take anything the Fed says with any credence whatsoever. And of course they do. That much is very obvious. And so what we're looking at here then, in that scenario, would be a situation where you get to a pricing that is not zero cuts, but perhaps something less than 25. And that's not far here. You would only have to move 5 basis points to get less than 25. And if that were the outcome, if the market were to walk away saying we may get none, that's probably negative for stocks because it leaves room for a readjustment in the outlook. It's probably positive for the US dollar. The most negative for stocks and the most positive for the US dollar is if the Fed openly puts the possibility of a hike on the table. That seems very unlikely. But if somewhere in the commentary, either at the press conference after or the policy statement, and it's probably in the press conference, where the markets pick up the scent around the possibility that it's not even just that we may get no cuts, it's that the Fed is open-minded or more open-minded than previously thought about hiking if inflation gets out of hand, that would probably be a very significant pain point for equities and a very advantageous one for the US dollar. However the Fed sets this lens, the next big test of how markets will respond is going to be Friday's US jobs report. And here the expectation is that we are going to get 243,000 jobs added to non-farm payrolls. That would be well within the 303 to 165 range that's been in place for the better part of a year at this point. So not a controversial number. The unemployment rate is seen holding steady at 3.8%. Again, well within the range that we've seen since basically the middle of 2021, early 2022, where we've kind of oscillated in a range of 3.4 to 4%, going very little distance in either way. And so this will be an interesting question. Of course, as ever, the reason this is so critical is because it goes to the heart of what the Fed is trying to engineer with monetary policy. We can see here that the decline in core inflation here, expressed as CPI, has kind of stalled a bit under 4%. The slide in headline CPI has also kind of stalled a bit, now 3.5%, but kind of idling here since the middle of last year. And clearly the pace of decline is fading here. And the argument from Fed officials has really been pretty straightforward, that the main issue here is sticky inflation in labor markets, because that's where they can really have some impact. That there's the influence of housing as well, but there's not much the Fed can do there short of actually starting to cut rates to unlock the market for both buyers and sellers that have been pushed out by the very quick jump in mortgage finance costs. Sellers don't want to sell because they don't want to then buy something that they have to refinance much more expensively, having locked in an existing mortgage at much lower rates. And buyers are priced out because the absence of sellers means the price isn't adjusting down and mortgage rates look much higher than they did even relatively recently. Let's call it 2 years ago. So with that in mind, you don't really get any kind of meaningful turnover in the housing market that clears it and brings both buyers and sellers back into the fray unless the Fed starts to cut. And they can't start to cut if inflation expectations and overall price growth is going in the wrong direction. And you can see that here with the employment cost index in the yellow. It's only down from 5.1 to 4.2%, less than 1% off the peak, whereas inflation is down much, much more. So this last step here, this last hurdle to get inflation to where the Fed wants it to go is ostensibly to squeeze labor markets enough that they begin to give you that next step. And as we can see here, there is still about a 2.2 million worker deficit that we see here between labor supply and labor demand, underpinning that inflation stuck in those markets. So from the Fed's perspective, first of all, the jobs data is going to be very important. If there is cooling in the labor market, that would be a welcome sign. It would also, of course, be a welcome sign for stock markets in that they would see more of a case for the Fed to be a little bit less hawkish. If the numbers are stronger, then it seems like job creation is still holding up and wages are still holding up, then we're getting to a place where the Fed can't afford to do much stimulus until something gives. Now, when we look at the way that U.S. economic data has performed relative to expectations, what we find is that it's increasingly deteriorating over the past 2-3 weeks or so. That seems to set the stage for a soft outcome on the jobs data, if in fact what it broadly reflects is analysts' models being rosier than reality is validating. With that in mind, if you get a Fed that ultimately gives the markets a risk-on lead, which is to say they don't overhawk it, and they say fewer cuts, but we still think some amount of cuts, that's probably already baked in, as we just said, then soft jobs data helps risk sentiment to build on whatever gains come out of that sort of a Fed. If, on the other hand, the Fed comes out more hawkish and gives the markets a jolt and says, actually, maybe no cuts, or worse yet, maybe a hike, we're not saying we're going to, we're saying we're open. Well, that's probably bad for stocks, probably good for the dollar. And then if you subsequently get soft jobs data, maybe that moderates some of the bloodletting that the Fed then initiates. Outside of the dollar, outside of the U.S. markets, and outside of U.S. economic data, there's some interesting bits and pieces here from the Eurozone, which may create opportunities around the dollar's relative relationship, especially to the euro. We're looking here at the incoming release of Eurozone CPI numbers. They're expected to show that price growth held unchanged at 2.4% for the second consecutive month. But if we look at the breakdown from March numbers, we can see disinflation appears to be broadening here. So the biggest sort of uplift to inflation last year was food, and we can see it's come in significantly here, much less of an issue now. And indeed, there seems to be more room for that to continue to happen because, as we've said before here, it looks like for those economies where food inflation was a big issue last year, the decline in global food costs, the FAO index from the United Nations here, tends to lead CPI by about 7 months. And as we can see here, there's more of this decline to price in that is yet to show up in CPI numbers, including for the Eurozone, of course. So that part of it looks like it's going to continue to work in the ECB's favor. The last kind of holdout here seems to be restaurants and hotels, so hospitality, discretionary spending. And there, the parallel release of GDP numbers out of the euro area might be very interesting indeed. What you see here is that really since the middle of 2022, the Eurozone economy has barely grown at all. It has been essentially on life support here. A little bit of a pop here, a little bit of a decline there, but growth has basically stopped. What we're looking for this time around is an increase of 0.1% after stagnation in the fourth quarter of last year. So from the looks of it, the discretionary spending part of this goes away out of the inflation calculus over time as this kind of economic weakness invariably is going to drive people away from the kind of spending they feel like they can forego and a shift more toward essentials in their spending mix. So with that in mind, these numbers probably set the stage for the ECB to cut rates in June as expected. At this point, three cuts are expected in all this year. That, of course, stacks up favorably for local stocks, but not so much for the local currency. And so we may see weakness in the euro here as this data comes across the wires relative to the dollar. And we'll see how the likes of EZU, the euro area stocks ETF, performs relative to S&P. They'll probably be both going in the generally same direction, but EZU might well outperform, so fall less or rise more because of this tailwind from the ECB. And that is Macro Money for today. As ever, we are here Monday through Thursday right after Overtime, which I co-host with Chris Vecchio and Dylan Radigan, looking at the Wall Street close and where we might be headed thereafter. Back on with Chris for Futures Power Hour on Fridays, on with Victor Jones for The Price of Truth on Wednesdays, back on with Vic on Sundays, along with Tom for First Call at the start of each week, writing for the News and Insights portion of tastylive.com, and opining sporadically on the platform formerly known as Twitter at Ilya Spivak. Thanks very much for joining. Macro Money is back tomorrow. See you then.
The content of this podcast is created, produced, and provided solely by Tasty Life, Inc. and does not represent the direct views or opinions of any of its affiliated companies. This content is for informational and educational purposes only. It is not, nor is it intended to be, trading or investment advice or a recommendation that any security, futures contract, digital asset, other product, transaction, or investment strategy is suitable for any person. Trading securities, futures products, and digital assets involve risk and may result in a loss greater than the original amount invested. Tasty Live Inc., through its content, financial programming, or otherwise, does not provide investment or financial advice or make investment recommendations. The information provided may not be appropriate for all investors and is provided without respect to individual investor financial sophistication, financial situation, investing time horizon, or risk tolerance. Tasty Live Inc. is not a licensed financial advisor, registered investment advisor, registered broker-dealer, or registered introducing